Today's episode of The Haunted Screen was brought to you by Fujifilm. Of all the companies I could be shilling for here, I am thankful that this is one whose products I actually like. I really do shoot on Fujifilm cameras, and I really do like the results. The images are crisp, the colors are gorgeous, and they're super intuitive to use. Now, fall's right around the corner at this point, so if you're thinking about investing in a new camera to take photos of the changing leaves on the trees or the kids going back to school, then give Fujifilm a look. They don't just make the haunted screen possible, though they do. Thanks, guys. They make possible every decent image I've taken over the past couple years. Okay, on with the show. Everybody knows that villains are cooler than heroes. Heroes are constrained. Being the good guy means that, well, you have to be good, and that can make you predictable, even a little bit boring. Luke Skywalker, Superman, yeah, they're iconic in their own way, but they're not what you would call exciting. The heroes that interest us most, they tend to have some darkness in them. Han Solo was a smuggler who was ready to shoot first and ask questions later. Batman deals with his abundant mental health issues by chasing after evil clowns and women in dominatrix outfits. Villains, they take this to the next level. They're free to fully embrace those dark tendencies, and humans are hardwired to be intrigued by that. This goes way back, all the way back to Eve being tempted by the serpent in the Garden of Eden. We're interested in characters that flout society's rules and eat the forbidden fruit, because some part of us wants to do that ourselves. And beyond that, villains give us the chance to face what scares us, but buffered by the safe distance of fiction. Death, cruelty, human depravity. We can look at them, process them, all while sitting safely in a movie theater or reading a book in an easy chair. Our villains tell us a lot about what we fear, both as individual humans and as subjects of history, situated in a specific time, place, and culture. Today we're going to look at two movie villains that were unleashed on Germany and the world exactly a century ago in 1922. Each of them stand in for the anxieties and social fissures that proliferated in Weimar society, and each helped to launch the career of a filmmaker who would become a major player in world cinema. If you're listening to this podcast, you've probably at least heard of the first one, Nosferatu, the vampire film directed by F.W. Murnau. The other, which is less remembered today but was more successful at the time, is Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, Fritz Lang's 4.5-hour long thriller. And yeah, apparently back in 1922, a 4.5-hour long movie could still qualify as thrilling. So welcome to the second episode of The Haunted Screen. My name is Travis Mushet, and today I'm going to tell you about some German bad guys worth rooting for. That's a sentence I never thought I would say.
Master,
speak.
Coach Feratu's presence was discovered by the humans. He has been destroyed.
Nubala, the mortal shall soon.
I'm sorry, what did you say his name was?
Coach Feratu.
Coach Feratu. That was his real name, like his actual vampire name?
No. His vampire name was Balak Alistain.
What the f would he name himself after a famous vampire movie? Was he doing a bit?
I do not know, Your Unholiness.
Jesus Christ, from now on, no more of this clever name bullshit. When a vampire is pretending to be a human, they can just call themselves Alan Jefferson or something like that. It's crazy, right? I mean, am I being an asshole?
F.W. Murnau was born Friedrich Wilhelm Plump in the Westphalian town of Bielefeld on December 28th, 1888. Plump in German, it doesn't mean the same thing as plump in English, but it's still not a flattering word. Basically, it means clumsy or awkward or inept, so you can understand why Wilhelm, as his friends called him, why he'd eventually drop his last name and adopt a pseudonym. Nosferatu, a symphony of horror, directed by F.W. Awkward. It doesn't exactly make the blood run cold. But Murnau, or the boy who would become Murnau, he was a precocious kid. His brother Robert remembered that by the time Wilhelm was 12, he was already reading the philosophy of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche in the plays of Shakespeare and Ibsen. Though his family's finances had some ups and downs, they were at one point wealthy, and Murnau carried himself with the bearing of a cultured aristocrat, even after his dad lost most of the family's money in a bad investment. If you remember, Carl Meyer, the co-writer of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, his father was also ruined by an unlucky trip to Monte Carlo. It kinda seems like financially illiterate fathers were a common origin story in the Weimar film industry. But Murnau certainly had a taste for the finer things. When he was studying at the University of Berlin, his landlady had to write to his dad to demand payment for his son's debts. His father sped off to the metropolis and found the boy's apartment crammed full of expensive modern art. Murnau, he got a talking to. And while he did rein in his spending, he didn't exactly become an obedient son. Some family friends were attending a play at the Deutsche Theater in Berlin, and an exceptionally tall actor drew their attention. Murnau was 6'4", and that made him pretty recognizable on stage. When the friends ratted him out to his parents, his dad cut off the cash flow, saying that he, quote, paid for him to become a professor, not a starving actor. His mom, though, she was more supportive of her son's artistic ambitions and persuaded her father, Murnau's grandfather, to secretly subsidize him with monthly checks. He was also supported by the family of the young poet Hans Ehrenbaum Degele. A lot of accounts of Murnau's life, especially the older accounts, they identify Hans as his best friend, but it's almost definitely the case that he and Hans were lovers. We can't be 100% sure about this because, as you might guess, being open about one's queer relationships wasn't an option when they found each other. It was 1907 when they went off to Berlin together as students. And even in Berlin, which by the 1920s would become maybe the most LGBTQ-friendly city in the world, even in Berlin they had to hide their relationship. Hans's mother was a celebrated opera singer, and his father was a Jewish banker. The Jewish part will become relevant as we move forward. And while it's unclear whether they were aware of the nature of their son's relationship, we do know that they loved not just their own child, but the teenaged Wilhelm as well. He was, by all accounts, part of the family. Then, the war came for them, as it did for nearly every young German man of their generation. Murnau was drafted in 1914, and Hans volunteered that same year. They kept up a correspondence, with Hans at one point sending Wilhelm a book of his own poetry. In one poem, Hans wrote, "You dream of country, happiness, and going home. Patience becomes duty, waiting becomes action. O gray night, O gray and misty night, soon will come death, sharp as a terrible blow. Dig your grave deeper, soldier." Shortly after he wrote those words in 1915, Hans was killed in action on the Eastern Front. As Wilhelm's brother euphemistically described, quote, "Murnau was deeply stricken by his friend's death." Their shared grief seems to have bonded Murnau even more deeply with Hans's family. He spent his leave with them in 1916, but brutally, this surrogate family was soon to be ripped away from him as well. Hans's father died not long after, and just a few years later, his mother followed. In her will, she left her home to the University of Berlin, but only on the condition that Wilhelm was allowed to live there for the rest of his life. There are a lot of things about war that feel pretty unimaginable to me. I have no idea what it would feel like to sprint toward enemy trenches with machine gun fire bearing down on me, but in World War I, millions of men did it, or were forced to do it by their superiors. Another aspect of war I can't imagine is how soldiers managed to keep it together and keep fighting when so many of them must have been in so much grief. Their friends, their brothers, their lovers, they were dying at a mind-boggling rate. You might remember from the first episode of this season that 1 in 25 Germans died in that war. Among enlisted soldiers, the figure is estimated to be around 1 in 7. Death was a constant presence, but they still had to keep fighting. And that's what Murnau did. He even became a fighter pilot for the Luftwaffe, and survived 8 crashes without any serious injury. He also managed to keep his spirits up enough to become popular among his comrades. One of them, Major Wolfgang Schramm, he remembered him as a curious mixture of a wandering gypsy and cultivated gentleman. Murnau would recite poems around the campfire, and during his time at what sounds like a particularly pleasant POW camp in Switzerland, he directed a play that earned an award from the Swiss government. And despite the war's harsh circumstances, Murnau didn't abandon his sense of style. When he crafted a walking stick out of a bullet-ridden propeller, the men around him were so impressed that they made their own. As Major Schramm put it, "Murnau used to create our fashions and customs. He was the accepted authority in his section on all cultural activities and accepted with a smile of pride any praise of his creative gifts." World War I finally ended in November of 1918. In February 1919, Murnau returned to Hans's parents' home in Berlin. He pretty immediately threw himself into the emerging German film industry. By this point, he'd moved away from acting to focus on directing, and he founded an independent production company with a friend from his theater days, Konrad Veidt. This is, of course, the same Konrad Veidt who would soon play Cesare, the gaunt, proto-goth sleepwalker in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. The next few years were prolific ones, as Murnau came to master both the mechanics and the subtleties of his new medium. In the 2 years before he started work on Nosferatu in 1921, he directed no fewer than 9 feature films. But since film preservation wasn't a priority at this point, only 2 of these early movies survive in their entirety. The truth is, we're really lucky that Nosferatu itself survived. The film is an unauthorized and barely concealed adaptation of the novel Dracula by Bram Stoker. Names and locations were changed, but the story was essentially the same. And when she found out about it, the author's widow, Florence Stoker, was furious. After a few years of legal wrangling, the courts ordered that all copies of Nosferatu should be burned. Thankfully, though, prints of the film had by that point made their way abroad, beyond the grasp of Mrs. Stoker. This litigious backstory became especially ironic when German director Werner Herzog set out to remake the film in the late 1970s, after Stoker's story finally entered the public domain.
And the funny thing is that when I started to make my film, the Murnau Foundation, who owns now the rights of the film, wanted to charge me copyright, and I said Murnau himself stole it and got in trouble and couldn't show the film. So I'm a thief without loot. Yeah. Face it.
Any excuse for a Herzog cameo, right? But despite being Nosferatu's director, the blame for this pretty blatant case of copyright infringement really doesn't fall on Murnau. After all, the film wasn't his idea. The driving force behind Nosferatu's production was an artist and architect named Albin Grau. Weimar Berlin was one of the weirdest, most interesting places in modern history. And even in that context, Grau was a notably weird, interesting guy. On top of his artistic output, he was a major player in Germany's occult circles, where he went by the name Father Pacitus. Grau was a high-ranking member in a mystical brotherhood known as the Ordo Templi Orientis, and he was even acquainted with the British magician Aleister Crowley, who would come to be called the wickedest man in the world, or, you know, the guy from that Ozzy song.
Mr. Crowley!
Grau wasn't a fan of Crowley's militantly anti-Christian theology, but dark, sinister subject matter held a special fascination for him. He even claimed to have heard firsthand accounts of vampire sightings during his wartime service in the Serbian campaign. After the conflict, Grau wrote the following account. It starts with an alleged quotation from a local peasant. "Before this wretched war, I was over in Romania. You can laugh about this superstition, but I swear on the mother of God that I myself knew that horrible thing of seeing an undead." "An undead?" one of us asked. "Yes, an undead or a Nosferatu, as vampires are known over there. Only in books have you heard those strange and disturbing characters spoken about, and you smile at these old wives' tales. But it's here, where we're at in the Balkans, that one finds the cradle of those vampires. We've been pursued and tormented by those monsters forever." Now, who knows whether or not Grau actually heard such a story when he was at war? And if he did, it seems likely that the peasant was just screwing with him. But what is clear is that he was dead set on making a vampire film. He's the one who co-founded a soon-to-be-bankrupt production company specifically to make this and other occult-themed movies. He's the one who created the concept art that was instrumental in establishing Nosferatu's visual style, including the iconic bald, bat-eared vampire himself. And he's the one who hired Heinrich Galeen to adapt Dracula into a screenplay, and F.W. Murnau to direct. So here's a quick summary of the movie they created together. It's the year 1838 in Wiesbaden, Germany, and an estate agent sends his young employee Thomas Hutter to Transylvania to meet with the mysterious Count Orlok.
I have a task for you. Something I don't dare trust to anyone else.
Orlok is interested in buying the house across the street from Hutter's own home, and it's up to him to close the deal. Hutter hops in his coach and heads to Orlok's castle.
A ghost castle. A traveler who enters into that land of phantoms is lost.
Orlok, it turns out, is one spooky specimen. Even if you haven't seen the movie, you've probably seen pictures of this guy. If you need a refresher, though, check out the show notes. Still pretty unsettling, right? It gets weirder. At dinner, Hutter cuts his thumb and Orlok tries to suck the blood.
Please, let me do it. It's the oldest remedy in the world.
Hutter is understandably creeped out and retires to his room. When he wakes up the next morning, he finds two little marks on his neck that he attributes to mosquitoes. Later on, Orlok signs the papers on his new house, and he notices Hutter's locket has a photo of his wife Ellen.
What a lovely throat.
The next day, Hutter's having a look through the castle when he comes upon a coffin. Orlok, of course, is asleep inside it. Once it gets dark, Hutter spies Orlok loading some coffins onto his coach before leaving for Wiesbaden. So the young man quickly takes off to protect his wife.
I've got to get out of here.
Orlok transfers from coach to ship for the last leg of his journey and kills everybody on board. Once he gets to Wiesbaden, he keeps up the murder, which everyone just blames on the plague.
Go home quietly, please. Shut the doors and windows.
Doing some research about the strange goings-on, Ellen learns that vampires can be defeated.
It should a woman pure of heart to make him forget the cry of the cock. The first light of day will destroy him.
Sure enough, Orlok shows up in Ellen's bedroom, and she allows him to feast on her blood. Which he does so greedily that he doesn't even notice the sun is rising. And, in what is Nosferatu's original contribution to vampire lore, the sunlight kills Orlok, saving Hutter and the rest of Wiesbaden from Ellen's fate. So that's the story. One that'll sound pretty familiar if you've read Dracula or seen one of its more faithful screen adaptations. The clips there, by the way, were borrowed from Herzog's 1979 take on the film. But regardless, it's not the plot that makes Nosferatu a classic. It's the images. Silent film was, of course, an almost entirely visual medium. Many movies didn't even have fixed musical scores, though Nosferatu was one of the first that did. But this nearly total focus on the visual suited Murnau remarkably well. Unlike Fritz Lang, who we'll be getting to in the second half of this episode, he wasn't skilled at painting and drawing, but he had an intuitive sense of what makes an image compelling. There's a reason he's been referred to as a Michelangelo without hands. But fortunately, he surrounded himself with people skilled enough to make his vision a reality. People like his cinematographer Fritz Arno Wagner. Where the world of Caligari was consciously distorted and unnatural, Nosferatu was shot mostly at real locations, on and near the coast of the Baltic Sea in northern Germany. Its camera is fascinated by the natural world, with its forests, mountains, and clouds. The Hungarian film theorist Béla Balázs one of the most important critics of his generation. He wrote that in Nosferatu, "We are not frightened by the dangerous options of the technique, but by the unknown mysteries of nature." What Balazs is observing here is evidence of the film's deeper artistic influences. Nosferatu definitely has expressionist elements, the exaggerated acting, the menacing mise-en-scene, the skillful use of light and shadow. But Murnau was equally influenced by the landscape paintings of German romantics of the early 19th century, like Caspar David Friedrich. Check out, for example, Friedrich's masterpiece, Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, which suggests both awe and terror in the face of the humbling magnitude of nature. But it's the image of the vampire himself, Count Orlok, that's burrowed itself in the popular consciousness and stayed there for a century. The fact that you're likely envisioning him right now is testament to this. In one of the all-time performances of the horror genre, he's played by a gaunt, leering Max Schreck. Schreck, by the way, is the German word for fright or scare. It's almost too perfect. This is a performance so convincing that Shadow of the Vampire, a film from the year 2000, it takes as its premise that Schreck was literally one of the undead, a creature whom we're now convinced to essentially play himself, unbeknownst to the casting crew.
So who's playing Count Dracula? Orlok.
His name is Schreck. Max Schreck. Apparently he was in the Reinhardt Company when Murnau was directing.
I never heard of any Max Schreck in the Reinhardt Company.
A doctor told me he was with Stanislavski in Moscow.
Oh dear, one of the Russian school then.
As part of his preparation, he submerges his own personality into that of the character he's playing. That is why he's not traveling with us.
In the real world, the actor was instrumental in creating the monster's iconic look. Working from Albin Grau's concept art, Schreck did his own makeup for the role, and there's really no arguing with the results. Orlok has none of the suaveness or sex appeal of most of pop culture's vampires. Your Draculas or Lestats or Edward Cullens. Unlike those guys, he looks like a creature with eternal life. The years have not been kind to him. He looks like a corpse that's animated by some kind of dark magic. It seems almost as though everything about Orlok comes to a point. His ears, his teeth, those long taloned fingers, that huge hooked nose. It's terrifying, exhilarating. And it draws from some of the most noxiously racist tropes in history. Yeah, you probably know where this is going, but we'll get there after the break.
It was a seduction, but mere carnality was not his aim. I was repelled and drawn in all at once. When he spoke, it was in Italian, but with a thick German accent. He revealed to me his name, F.W. Murnau, the great German director.
What did he want from you?
I thought he meant to kill me, but instead, he wished to preserve me.
The overlap between the appearance of Count Orlok and the anti-Semitic cartoons that proliferated in Germany from the 19-teens and 20s and on through the Nazi era are pretty uncomfortable. If you want a side-by-side comparison, look at the show notes. It's more than a little upsetting, especially if you're someone like me, who has a lot of affection for this movie. That big bald head, those fangs, those claws, and especially that oversized nose. Orlok isn't too far away from drawings that you'd see in Der Stürmer, the most virulently racist of the Nazi-aligned newspapers. In fact, those drawings may have been directly influenced by Nosferatu. The website for the Museum of the Jewish People in Tel Aviv claims that Julius Streicher, the founder and publisher of Der Stürmer, that he was present at the film's premiere, and that he became so obsessed that he returned to watch the movie over and over again. The museum says, quote, "For Streicher, the vampire represented the other, the deformed, ugly, un-German, disease-ridden well-poisoner. In other words, the Jew." Now, this is information that I haven't been able to corroborate anywhere else. For this podcast, I've read multiple books specifically about Nosferatu, and none of them offer any other accounts of Streicher being at the premiere. So take the museum's claim with a grain of salt. But even if the story is apocryphal, and if I'm being honest, I suspect that it is, it speaks to the striking and disturbing similarities between the vampire and the anti-Semitic stereotypes circulating in Germany at the time. Even beyond Orlok's physical appearance, there are reasons to see traces of anti-Semitism in the film. First and foremost is the fact that the monster in question is a vampire. If you're not well acquainted with history's vast compendium of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, well, I envy your innocence, which I am about to sully. But from the Middle Ages forward, there has been a stubborn and manifestly untrue accusation leveled against Jewish communities known as blood libel. Blood libel is the claim that Jews routinely slaughter Christian children in order to use their blood in religious rituals, typically by including it as an ingredient in the matzah bread served at Passover seders. Yeah. And people believe this, or rather they choose to believe this, up to the present day. As recently as March 2020, the Italian artist Giovanni Gasparo, who has received the patronage of the Roman Catholic Church and shown his work at the hyper-prestigious Venice Biennial, he unveiled a painting that earnestly depicts the mythical 15th century murder of a Christian child by Jews. Given all this history, it can be, upsetting to watch the climactic scene in Nosferatu, where a hook-nosed Count Orlok feasts on the blood of Ellen, an innocent blonde Aryan. There is, however, no reason to think that Murnau was personally anti-Semitic, or that he set out to turn his vampire into a distinctly Jewish villain. Alexander Granik, who played Hutter's traitorous boss Er Nock in Nosferatu, he was a friend of Murnau since their acting school days. He was also Jewish, and in his memoirs, Granik remembers Murnau being protective of him and defending him when one of their professors let loose an anti-Semitic tirade. And don't forget, the man who could be said to be the love of Murnau's life, Hans Arenbaum Degela, he was himself half-Jewish. What's more, Nosferatu's screenwriter, Heinrich Gehlein, was also a Jew. So this wasn't some anti-Semitic slander film of the kind that would become so ubiquitous after Hitler rose to power in 1933 and installed his minister of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, atop the German film industry. It's not some sickening cinematic artifact of bigotry like The Eternal Jew or Jude Seuss. But intentionally or not, the specific prejudices and anxieties of an era are inevitably going to bubble up in that era's art, and especially in its horror movies, a genre of films that set out to find and exploit the things that upset us and scare us. In the 1956 American film Invasion of the Body Snatchers, alien spores grow to perfectly replicate the human inhabitants of a California town.
They come from another world, spawned in the light years of space, unleashed to take over the bodies and souls of the people of our planet, bringing a new dimension in terror to the giant super scope screen.
The characters have trouble telling their neighbors apart from the extraterrestrial infiltrators, and the paranoia that sets in has been widely interpreted as an allegory of Cold War anxiety, when a lot of Americans became obsessed with rooting out closeted communists in their midst. And in 1968's Night of the Living Dead, the protagonist, a black man, he survives the zombie hordes only to be shot dead by a truckload of white vigilantes who mistake him for a threat, for one of the ghouls infesting their town.
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
In both cases, the filmmakers insisted that they did not set out to make political films. But the politics seeped in, or at least were read into these movies by the audiences who watched them through the lens of their own historical context. So what was the historical context in Germany in 1922? How could such ugly tropes have wormed their way into a mainstream film made by artists who were, by all accounts, not anti-Semites? Well, the history of bigotry towards the Jewish community in Europe is depressingly long, and there's no way I can exhaustively cover it here. But it is worth looking into some of the immediate history, particularly with regard to World War I. One of the war's great underreported realities is that a larger share of the German Jewish population fought in the conflict than any other ethnic group in the country. At the time, there were about 550,000 Jews in Germany. 100,000 of them, nearly one in five, served in the military. That's 44% of German Jewish males, which is an astounding figure when you consider that many of the non-combatants were too young, too old, or medically unfit for military service. By and large, this community didn't see their Jewishness and their Germanness as being at odds, and they were as likely as any of their countrymen to be swept up by war fever. By the end of the conflict, 12,000 of them had died in battle. Over 30,000 had earned medals. 2,000 rose through the ranks to become officers. This, however, apparently wasn't enough to prove their loyalty. Anti-Semites in the German military had convinced themselves that, to quote an order from the Prussian war minister, large numbers of Jews in military service are said to have obtained assignments in administrative or clerical posts far away from the front lines, either with the rear echelon or in the homeland. To justify these prejudices, the war ministry ordered a Judenzalung, which translates to Jew count or Jew census. These findings were never released to the public. The German command claimed that this decision was made to, quote, spare Jewish feelings. This was bullshit. The count itself definitively debunked the racist allegations. A full 80% of Jews in the army were on the front lines. Burying these findings was meant to inflame or at least maintain German anti-Semitism, not to mitigate it. By taking the census at all, and then choosing not to release the exonerating results, the war ministry laid the seeds for the most damaging conspiracy theory of the Weimar era, the Dolchstoßlegende, or the stab in the back myth. If you ever took a class in European history, you're probably familiar with this particular line of nonsense. Essentially, the stab in the back myth is the lie that Germany would have won the Great War if the country hadn't been actively and maliciously undermined by certain elements on the home front. Those certain elements are exactly who you'd guess. Socialists, anti-monarchists, and Jews. Most of all, Jews. This myth was a convenient way for the military leadership, like the hyper-nationalist bigot General Erich Ludendorff, to deflect blame for losing the war, and for the German public to process the shock of defeat. See, during wartime, the German press had essentially become a propaganda outfit. It portrayed victory as inevitable, so when the country surrendered, people were left confused and grasping for an explanation. This probably goes without saying, but the Dolchstoßlegende has nothing to do with the truth. The tide had definitively turned against Germany when the first American troops landed in France in June 1917, if not earlier, and that was a year and a half before the war's end. But everybody loves a scapegoat, or loves to hate them, and Germany's long-standing anti-Semitism made Jews an easy target, especially after the November Revolution that we discussed in Episode 1. Many of the leaders of the communist revolts that followed the collapse of the monarchy were Jewish, which proved a convenient excuse for right-wing Germans to weave their two favorite boogeymen together. There was also a particular antipathy for the so-called Eastern Jews from countries like Russia and Poland. Where German Jews were largely assimilated into the culture that surrounded them, their co-religionists abroad tended to be more devout and preserved more of their specifically Jewish culture and customs. German Jews were modern and urbanized. Speaking broadly, they looked like any other German. Eastern Jews were typically agrarian, living in ethnically homogenous shtetls rather than big, diverse cities. They wore distinctive clothing, they spoke Yiddish, and many German Jews viewed them with embarrassment. The Jewish scholar, Victor Klemperer, who worked as a military censor during the war, he wrote the following about the Eastern Jews. "No, I did not belong to these people, even if one proved my blood relation to them 100 times over. I belonged to Europe, to Germany, and I thanked my creator that I was German." And this was a common perspective among German Jews at the time, perhaps even the prevailing perspective. Of course, though, ethnic Germans viewed the Eastern Jews with even more contempt than the German Jews did. So in Germany, in the years after World War I, there was a xenophobia layered on top of the anti-Semitism. And you can see the fingerprints of these prejudices in Nosferatu. Count Orlok is not a creature of Germany. He's foreign, from Transylvania, from the East. In a film that's set in the 1830s, during what's known as the Biedermeier era, he looks like a sinister medieval relic, much the way that Germans thought of Eastern Europeans, especially Jewish Eastern Europeans. And significantly, Orlok's evil is not contained to his homeland. He sails into Wisborg, importing havoc and suffering into Germany from abroad. Notably, he does so on a ship full of rats, delivering mass death that the town folk initially blame on the plague. This is representative of a fear of foreigners that would come to animate the Nazi Party, which was founded in 1920 and fell under Hitler's leadership in 1921. Remember, Nosferatu was released in 1922, and the imagery of disease and pestilence that the film evoked had some very specific valences at that point in history. For example, here is a piece of narration from The Eternal Jew, a vile Nazi propaganda film from 1940. Comparable with the Jewish wanderings through history are the mass migrations of an equally restless animal, the rat. Wherever rats appear, they bring ruin. They ravage human property and foodstuffs. In this way, they spread disease, plague, leprosy, typhoid, cholera, dysentery, etc. They are cunning, cowardly, and cruel, and are found mostly in packs. In the animal world, they represent the element of craftiness and subterranean destruction, no different from the Jews among mankind. It's this imagery that Nosferatu draws from, likely unconsciously. This is a movie made by filmmakers who were not anti-Semitic, and there's nothing in the plot that explicitly names or targets Jews, even if Hebrew is included in the strange alchemical scribblings that we see Orlok reading. But when you live in a culture, you draw from that culture's tropes and storytelling conventions. In Germany, in 1922, the tropes for evil, for the disgusting, for the repellent, they were often coded as Jewish. Nosferatu reflects that cultural reality, even if Murnau wasn't conscious of it. None of this is to say that Nosferatu should be relegated to the dustbin of history, or, as they say, canceled. It is, I believe, a genuine classic, and one made without malice and with the involvement of Jewish artists. For me, at least, and it should be said I am not myself Jewish, but for me, understanding its relationship to history doesn't ruin Nosferatu. Rather, it deepens our understanding of the film, just as the film deepens our understanding of history. Hey, it's me, your faithful host, fulfilling my contractual duties and giving you one more reminder that Fujifilm cameras really are great. So let me tell you a quick story. Just a month or so ago, my sister and I got hired for a freelance gig where we had to approach and interview random people on the streets of New York. Now, I am an introvert, so dealing with strangers kind of mortifies me. But since Fujifilm had my back, at least I didn't have to worry about the quality of my footage. I have literally field tested this gear. The results were excellent, the client was psyched, etc., etc., etc. So if you're on the market for a camera, do yourself a favor and consider the folks at Fujifilm. ...1922 was a tumultuous time in Germany, and Count Orlok wasn't the only villain to tap into the unease that was so thick in the air. So did the title character of the two-part, four-and-a-half-hour epic, Dr. Mabuse the Gambler. Now, in our next episode, we're really going to dive into the lives of the power couple behind that movie, the director Fritz Lang and the screenwriter Thea von Harbou. So I'm going to sidestep the biographical context right now and just jump right into the film. At 4.5 hours, this is obviously a long one to sit through, but I promise it does lend itself to watching in digestible chunks. The movie is divided into 12 chapters, each of which averages just over 20 minutes. Or you can watch it like they did at Mabuse's premiere in April 1922, taking it in two parts on successive nights. But for those of you who very understandably don't have the endurance or maybe the desire to sit through this one, here's a summary of what happens. Dr. Mabuse, the scoundrel who gives the film its name, he's a criminal genius right out of a Bond movie.
We shall see a new power dominating the world.
He's a master of disguise, a hypnotist, a counterfeiter of currency, and a psychiatrist. And he's worshipped by a small crew of henchmen, including the cabaret dancer Kara Carraza, who is desperately in love with the monster she believes to be, quote, the greatest man alive.
That's me, darling. Unusual places, unusual love affairs.
We're introduced to Mabuse as he executes an intricate scheme to sow chaos at the stock market, a plot that secures a big payday for himself and spells disaster for his unlucky victims.
You realize what this means? It means bankruptcy and scandal!
Next, he heads for a Spielklub, or gambling den, where he hypnotizes the son of a wealthy industrialist and forces him to throw a card game, which, of course, further pads our villain's wallet.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
These exploits draw the attention of Norbert von Wink, a clever prosecutor who is looking for connections between the suspicious goings-on that are raging through Berlin. The film becomes a cat-and-mouse game between von Wink and Mabuza, essentially our Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty. And as the prosecutor closes in on the gangster, both of them find themselves enamored with the gorgeous, world-weary Countess Tolt.
I want you to live with me and die with me and everything with me.
Mabuza kidnaps her, and under the auspices of his day job as a psychoanalyst, he takes on her husband Count Tolt as a client and manipulates him into suicide. Meanwhile, the police apprehend the lovelorn Kara Carraza, who also kills herself rather than betray Mabuza.
Oh, happy Dakar.
Apparently, this body count isn't high enough for the doctor. So when von Wink stops by his office to inquire about what could have driven Count Tolt to off himself, Mabuza cons him into attending a magic show of a certain Xandor Veltman. Of course, Veltman is Mabuza in disguise, and he uses the performance as a chance to hypnotize the prosecutor.
Look at me in the eyes.
Now under Mabuza's spell, von Wink hops into his car and tries to drive it off a cliff. Thankfully, his men stop him just in time, and now awakened from his hypno-haze, he's able to put the pieces together and identify Mabuza as the fiend who is wreaking havoc throughout the city.
He's the real monster.
The police surround Mabuza's house, and an epic gunfight ensues. Things do not go the doctor's way. The Countess gets rescued, and his sidekicks are all either killed or captured. So our villain tries to make a last-ditch escape through an underground tunnel. But rather than finding his way to freedom, he accidentally ends up locked in the cellar. There he has ghostly visions of the people he's killed. And by the time the police finally find him, he's been driven insane. Okay, even with all that plot, I had to leave out plenty. Like I said, this is a 4.5-hour movie we're talking about. But critics and audiences in Germany had the patience for it. Unlike Nosferatu, Mabuza was a hit. And also unlike Nosferatu, this film was immediately recognized as an artifact of its historical moment. Indeed, it was even marketed as an up-to-the-minute commentary on Weimar Germany. You can see this in the subtitles of Mabuza's two parts. Part 1, A Picture of Our Time, and Part 2, A Play About People of Our Time. The actor who played Dr. Mabuza, and played him with an appropriately mesmerizing dark charisma, was named Rudolf Klein Roga. And Roga saw his character as an embodiment of the era, telling an interviewer that Mabuza was, quote, a symptom of a Europe that was falling apart. The newspapers agreed that there was something distinctly now about the film, calling it both a mirror of the age and a document of our time. Some of the connections to the real world are obvious. Mabuza is, among other things, a counterfeiter, and in that dazzling opening sequence, we see him throw the stock market into a tailspin. That economic instability was something that German audiences could definitely relate to. Though inflation hadn't yet hit the absurd levels you'd see by 1923, that train was leaving the station by the beginning of the decade. Prior to World War I, a single US dollar was worth just over 4 German marks. By the war's end in 1918, the rate nearly doubled to roughly 8 marks per dollar. In 1919, a dollar would buy you 33 marks. In 1920, it's 57. Then in June 1921, just a few months before Dr. Mabuza went into production, the winners of the war came to collect their first reparations payments. See, when the Allied powers drew up the Treaty of Versailles to officially end the Great War, they included a controversial provision called Article 231, better known as the War Guilt Clause. This clause, which the Germans were forced to accept, stipulated that Germany and the countries that sided with it were totally to blame for the conflict. As we discussed in our first episode of this season, when we looked at the causes of the war, this claim doesn't hold up to scrutiny. The causes of World War I are still being debated among historians, and scholars differ when it comes to the relative responsibility that they place on each combatant. What is clear, though, is that there was plenty of blame to go around. Germany was an enthusiastic participant in the bloodbath, but so were Britain and France. The War Guilt Clause wasn't just a matter of national honor, though it certainly was that. It also provided the legal basis for forcing Germany to pay reparations for the damage it had inflicted on its opponents. they were on the hook for 132 billion gold marks, around $550 billion in today's money. The first installment came due in June 1921, and Germany couldn't pay it by conventional means, so it got, I guess you could say creative. The country decided to print more currency to meet the payments, causing the value of the mark to slip even further, to 330 marks per dollar. Things would, of course, get much, much worse. By late 1923, you'd need to exchange 4.2 trillion marks for a single US dollar. To have enough money to buy anything, people had to push around their money in wheelbarrows. Clerks at stores took to weighing the stacks of bills on scales because counting them just wasn't feasible. Households even burned cash for warmth because it was cheaper than firewood. According to the economist John Kenneth Galbraith, the constant demand on people to make calculations of ever-shifting currency values could lead to a psychological condition called zero stroke, which manifested in a compulsion to write out endless rows of zeros. Things hadn't gotten that bad by the time Mabuza was released in 1922, but the economy's downward trajectory was already clear, and Fritz Lang put that emerging financial mayhem on the screen. Both for Dr. Mabuza and for flesh and blood Germans, the economic climate and the trauma of the war had cultural consequences. As the filmmaker Jean Renoir wrote of his time in Berlin in the early 1920s, Sodom and Gomorrah were reborn there. The German people were shell-shocked, both literally and metaphorically, and the nihilistic, live-for-the-moment ethos that would define Weimar Berlin was starting to take hold. With the conservative monarchy toppled, Germans were free to pursue their passions at sex clubs, cabarets, and porn theaters. Cocaine and opium were sold openly on the street, and so was sex. When the American actor and writer Anita Loos wrote that in Berlin, sex is the business of the town, she wasn't wrong. Here's how the novelist Christopher Isherwood remembers it.
Paris had absolutely cornered the idea of girls, girls in every shape and form. They had to have a sort of new specialty. And so suddenly, I think this was done quite unconsciously, but I think, I still believe that it has a certain social reality that they sort of instinctively felt, well, we've got to offer something different to the tourists. And so, oh, we'd be perverse. That'd be a wonderful thing. We'd all be perverse. And anything was perverse that wasn't sort of straight down the line. And that became that kind of stock in trade.
Depending on who's counting and the definition they were using, this city of 2 million people was home to as many as 120,000 female prostitutes and another 35,000 men. This means that as many as 1 in 13 Berliners were involved in the sex trade. Whatever it was that revved your engine, it was available as long as you had the money, especially if you were a foreigner with hard currency to spend. The leather-clad dominatrixes known as boot girls looked for clients around Wittenberger Platz in the Schöneberg neighborhood. A writer who arrived in the city during the heart of the inflation crisis remembers them like this. Some of them looked like fierce Amazons, strutting in high boots made of green glossy leather. One of them brandished a supple cane and leered at me as I passed by. "Good evening, madam," I said. She whispered into my ear, "Wanna be my slave? Cost only $6 billion and a cigarette. Come along, honey." These women advertised their services through an elaborate system of color-coded boots, laces, and ribbons. Do you get off to verbal mockery? Look for a boot girl with maroon laces. Need someone to shit on your chest? Watch for gold laces. Want to lay on a bed and have your buttocks beat? Look for women in black boots. Prefer to be tied down while she beats your ass? It's brick red boots you need to watch out for. Or maybe you specifically need to start your sexual encounter in a dominant role and end it as a sub. Just find a woman with white ribbons on top of her boots. Now, sex work should be legalized. Criminalizing it just puts the people, especially the women, who participate in the sex trade at risk, and as long as everyone involved consents, other people's sex lives are none of our damn business. But when economic conditions are desperate, the line between consent and coercion gets murky. Here's Isherwood again.
And also you have to remember that this was a period of incredible poverty. When I think they said as much as 3/4 of the population were suffering from, to some degree, from malnutrition. And people really, had to face the fact of selling themselves if only they could.
Somewhere between 40 and 50,000 of the city's sex workers were of the category known as half-silks. These women had other jobs, often as secretaries or shopkeepers, but they turned to part-time prostitution to supplement their meager incomes and make ends meet. Even more bleak were the medicine girls. These child prostitutes were prescribed by pimps masquerading as medical doctors. Telephone girls were also, well, girls. Clients could call a number and ask for a favorite celebrity, say Marlene Dietrich or Lil Dagover, and a child who purportedly looked like the starlet in question would be delivered to their doorstep. With the place that Weimar Berlin occupies in the cultural imaginary, it can be easy to idealize it as a kind of dark Eden, a brief chapter of creative ferment and personal liberation that the Nazis would destroy in 1933. Now that's not untrue, but it's not the whole story either. Berlin was also a place with no small amount of suffering and exploitation. As we spend this season looking at some of the really revolutionary art that emerged from that era, it's important that we remember that life for the average Berliner wasn't lived at cabaret shows, raucous parties, and avant-garde salons. Dr. Mabuza doesn't take us into those darkest depths of Weimar Berlin. Ultimately, it's a thriller, not a somber piece of social realism. That said, Weimar debauchery is woven through the film like a leitmotif. As the title reminds us, Herr Doktor is a gambler, and he finds many of his marks in the gambling hall. Mabuza's doomed admirer, Kara Carraza, is a cabaret performer that the doctor uses to lure in his targets. His loyal servant, Spoeri, is addicted to cocaine. In a kind of meta moment, Lang even implies that expressionist art is itself a manifestation of Berlin's decadence and decay. The sets for the film's ubiquitous casinos and card dens would look at home in the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and the dead-eyed Count Told has a home stuffed with paintings that evoke expressionism and cubism. The canvases, however, do not impress Dr. Mabuza, who dismisses them as just a game. The critic Paul Cook summarized the film's view of the art movement like this: expressionism, like Weimar Germany, is empty of meaning. It is all form and no content. It's almost like Fritz Lang wanted to have his expressionism and eat it too, at once taking advantage of the style's striking aesthetics while simultaneously dismissing its intellectual or spiritual heft. The movie's climactic gunfight between Mabuza's gang and the police was also evocative for German moviegoers. Remember that the wreckage of World War I threw the country into a revolution that lasted from October of 1918 to August 1919. This revolution, however, wasn't fought in the trenches. It was fought in the streets. A general strike in March 1919 kicked off a round of fighting in Berlin that killed as many as 3,000 people. That same spring, radical leftists seized control of Munich and established the short-lived Bavarian Soviet Republic. Ironically, on International Workers' Day, May 1st, the combined forces of the German army and the paramilitary Freikorps fought their way into the city, using flamethrowers, heavy artillery, armored vehicles, and even aircraft. They crushed Munich's communists and anarchists in the space of 5 days. Over 600 people were killed. More than half of them were civilians. On top of that, the government executed over 1,000 leftists in the aftermath of the Soviet Republic's downfall. So when audiences saw Mabuza and his men shooting rifles out apartment windows as the police take cover in doorways and alleys, it didn't read as fantasy. Many of them had seen or even participated in that kind of violence just a few years earlier. Their country was still coping with the consequences. And these connections appear to have been intentional. Eric Palmer, who produced this film, as well as The Cabin of Dr. Caligari, he said that the character of Dr. Mabuza was a kind of spiritual heir to the left-wing revolutionaries, conning, kidnapping, and sometimes even killing members of the German upper crust. Fritz Lang saw his film as a kind of bizarro documentary of Weimar chaos, even claiming that he originally planned to open the movie with a montage of actual footage of revolutionary combat. But more than any specific historical references, Dr. Mabuza the Gambler and the magnetic villain at its center capture the general mood of Germany in the early 1920s. Its zeitgeist, if you will. The tumult of Weimar Germany was multifaceted: political, economic, and cultural. Everything that had seemed so solid before the war, an advanced economy, the monarchy, traditional norms and customs, it had all seemingly melted into air. The program handed out at the film's premiere was forthright about the links between Mabuza and Germany's generalized state of mayhem, saying, quote, "Mankind, swept about and trampled down in the wake of war and revolution, takes revenge for years of anguish by indulging in lusts and by passively or actively surrendering to crime." At the same time, though, the film simplifies all the complex historical forces that led the country to this point by essentially pinning them on one single bad guy. The prosecutor, Von Wink, refers to this all-powerful monster as the Great Unknown, but we of course know it to be Dr. Mabuza himself. He's the man behind the curtain, a fantastical and fantastically simple explanation for why things are the way they are. The critic Siegfried Krakauer argued that Mabuza's ability to control minds and his seemingly limitless power over society anticipated the rise of Hitler. But Herr Doktor seems more interested in reveling in chaos than in trying to impose some kind of fascist order onto it. More interesting is the line of thought that sees Mabuza, the architect of social collapse, as a character that's coded as Jewish. Mabuza is a doctor of psychiatry, after all, and in the Germany of the 1920s, psychoanalysis and Jewishness were seen as inextricably intertwined. The field's founder, Sigmund Freud, was an Austrian Jew, and when he founded the Wednesday Psychological Society, which is considered to have launched the psychoanalytic movement, all four other charter members were Jewish as well. What's more, when Mabuza disguises himself, he often impersonates people or professions that Germans would associate with the Jewish community. The most obvious example comes when he wears the beard and black hat of an Orthodox Jewish peddler, but at various points he also dresses up as a stockbroker, a professor, and a socialist agitator. Especially in the anti-Semitic imagination of Weimar Germany, audiences would be primed to see each of these characters as Jewish. And what could be a better cinematic manifestation of the stab-in-the-back myth than a Jew secretly undermining the German social order? The Nazis certainly saw it that way, with one Nazi critic writing that Mabuza was a quintessential Jewish figure, hell-bent on achieving mastery of the world. So that brings us full circle. Both of these villains, Count Orlok and Dr. Mabuza, they aren't just compelling characters. They're pinholes that let us peer into the Weimar era, and prisms through which we can see that era's prejudices and anxieties refracted onto the movie screen. And next week, we'll be looking at the husband-wife team that brought Mabuza to life, the director Fritz Lang, and the screenwriter Thea von Harbou. If you're following along, the films we'll be focusing on are 1921's Destiny, 1924's Die Nibelungen, and Metropolis from 1927. All of these movies can be streamed for free on YouTube. Watch if you want, and don't if you don't. Either way, I hope to see you there. The theme song for The Haunted Screen, as well as other music, comes courtesy of the Great Pacific Garbage Vortex. Additional music from Coma Media, Antipodean Writer, Arndt Stelter, and Audionautics. In accordance with the principles of fair use, we use clips from Rick and Morty, UCTV, Ozzy Osbourne, 1979's Nosferatu the Vampire, Shadow of the Vampire, American Horror Story, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Night of the Living Dead, The Eternal Jew, You Only Live Twice, Cabaret, It's a Wonderful Life, Wall Street, Lolita, Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, Svengali, Dr. Kim, and Memories of Berlin. The spooky ghost noise in the Mabuza sequence is courtesy of Lara Sloiter. Thanks so much to our sponsor Fujifilm, and of course to you for sharing your time with me. Until next episode.